This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our radio Main Street across North Dakota. And I'm back from a long summer break, just in time for our fall membership drive with Ashley Thornburg to remind you that if you're listening right now, you are needed to support Main Street. Right, Ashley?
Oh, absolutely. And welcome back, Doug. And we want to say welcome to anybody who is thinking about becoming a member and then deciding to become a member. Because, of course, to go from a listener, we very much appreciate, to a member means that you are taking an active role in supporting everything that you hear on Prairie Public. It's a nice, simple process. You can go online and make a donation at prairiepublic.org, or better yet, pick up that phone and call 800-359-4145.
Prairie Public is a non-commercial, non-profit public radio station that counts on voluntary contributions for the majority of our operating budget. That means you. Of course, we cover news and issues on our show and the big story of our century, the COVID-19 pandemic. So we're asking you to help us produce what you're listening to by pledging at prairiepublic.org or calling us 800-359-4145. There's never been a better time to get involved.
And we understand that a number of people are facing some budget concerns during this time of a global pandemic, and that is why it has become a little bit harder for us to do what we need to do to keep you informed. So those of you who have the resources to step in and help maybe a little extra this time, please consider that we are doing more with less in a time of unprecedented changes in information and also dire health consequences that we are staying on top of, not to mention it's a presidential election year. So give us a call with your investment in quality programming, 1-800-359-4145, or you can click and join at prairiepublic.org.
The expenses for Prairie Public grow, and of course, as Ashley hinted at, we're dealing with reduced income, not only from members who've had to reduce or cancel their contributions, but our business underwriting revenue is down. So you hear these little unobtrusive announcements, which basically serve a thank you for their financial support, you know. Those are the underwriters. And you are an underwriter, too. We're asking you, if you're a listener or a member, to consider raising your contribution or becoming a sustaining member, investing in what you're hearing right now. It's easy to do. It's prairiepublic.org or calling us at 800-359-4145.
And today we're going to let you know about a new partnership between the University of North Dakota and Sanford Health that is looking to expand healthcare offerings across the state. They are in the first phase of that partnership. They just launched a website, behavioralhealthbridge.org, with free mental and behavioral health resources. I spoke with Dr. Stephen Wunderlich, who is the Vice President of Research at Sanford Health, and Dr. Andrew McLean, who is Chair of the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Science at the UND School of Medicine and Health Sciences. Dr. Wunderlich, thanks for joining us today.
Sure.
Dr. McLean, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
I know that on the website, behavioralhealthbridge.com, I noticed a number of references to COVID-19, but I'm wondering, was this in the works at all before this pandemic? It seems like there's a lot of material on there already.
You know, Andy and I were in the same department. I was in his department at UND for many years, and so we've had a lot of conversations about mental health delivery and various issues over the years, but it was the end of March, I think. We had a phone call on a Sunday afternoon, and we were just talking about the pandemic and the magnitude of it, and then just based on some of our previous experiences, whether it's following the SARS virus in 2003 or tornadoes or hurricanes, you know, we just began thinking about the mental health implications, and really, that's how it got started. Was we thought we needed to start to prepare ourselves and hopefully the community and the state and the region for the potential mental health implications of the pandemic. And so it actually did grow out of the pandemic.
So why do you think, Dr. Wunderlich, that it took a pandemic to really bring this specific topic to the forefront?
Well, I might just rephrase it a little bit. I think we've always been thinking about how do we deliver mental health services in a rural state with big geography and not a lot of mental health providers. And, you know, we've been doing things like telehealth and trying to build telehealth both at UND and in Sanford for some time. But I do think that starting to think about the potential impact of the pandemic in terms of the virus, the social isolation, the potential impact on employment, and all the things that have affected all of us, it really just brought it into a little sharper focus, and it seemed like a really great opportunity to try and build some of these things because we thought they'd be needed.
Mm. Dr. McLean, the website, you know, right away addresses it as behavioral health. And already Dr. Wunderlich has said mental health a couple of times. I'm wondering, should we be using those two terms interchangeably?
Right, Ashley. It's kind of a cultural thing. In some countries, when you say behavioral health, they're referring primarily to psychology. In the U.S., we've landed on behavioral health to mean both mental health and substance use disorders usually. So when we're talking behavioral health, it encompasses not only the mental health side, but also those individuals who are struggling with substance use issues. And if I could expand on what Dr. Wunderlich was saying, back in March, there was so much information coming from so many different sources, and it was just overwhelming, I think, to the public, but also to providers. And so part of our conversation at that time was, you know, how can we, you know, utilize or bring people to a user-friendly, current, evidence-based site so that they're not having to reach here and there and hear a lot of actually conflicting information.
Yeah, because anybody thinks they're a doctor with Google out there. And then all of a sudden you're like, oh, I have every disease ever known
exactly.
to man.
Yep, we call that the med student syndrome.
I've been there. On the website, there are a number of different categories: the impact of COVID-19, stress and coping, caring, there's some self-care and also caring for loved ones, support and treatment, and then there's a section for healthcare providers as well. And I want to start with that support segment. Dr. McLean, can you paint a picture of just how important a support system is for maintaining behavioral and mental health?
Yeah, actually, as Dr. Wunderlich mentioned, the social connectedness, that's huge. When we looked at both individual and community resilience, one of the major factors, protective factors, is social connectedness. And so, isolation increases not only mental health, behavioral health problems, it has an impact on physical health. And so there aren't a lot of things that that we can always control, but in terms of reaching out to others and accepting communication from others, that's something that we can do. One of the things that we've talked about is, imagine what this would have been like 15, 20 years ago when we didn't have the technology, the internet, the infrastructure, the social media. I think this would have been much more difficult. The dilemma is there's so much noise out there, and particularly with social media, it's great for connecting, but there can be negative consequences as well.
Well, yeah, there is such a thing as too much technology. Dr. Wunderlich, how do you address just that aspect of it, the fact that we can be spending too much time online in terms of using online resources?
Well, we just reviewed some of the literature out in the world looking at past epidemics and problems similar to this pandemic. And there's kind of a profile of people who seem to be most vulnerable to having behavioral health problems.
Mm.
And one of the characteristics that does predict is the amount of time they spend online, on their devices, watching news. That seems to be a risk factor that, you know, thankfully we can control a little bit, but the people who are spending most of the time on their devices are at greater risk.
Yeah. Well, and there's got to be a quality issue there, too. If I am, for example, watching something really depressing or something really violent on a device versus if I'm reading on a Kindle and you know, sitting with my cat, they're both device times. But can you kind of talk more about the quality of what you're taking in on these devices?
Yeah, I think what, and that's a very good point. I mean, if you're sitting and reading a nice novel on your Kindle, that's one thing. But if you're on social media and you're tracking, you know, the virus incidence rates day to day to day, and you're starting to look at all the other things going on in the world that are, you know, crisis oriented, I think what it does is it just kind of activates people, and that's really part of the problem. Is when people's stress levels get higher, their bodies change, their minds change, it begins to tip certain people toward developing more kind of enduring and significant problems. But it's more of the social media, news-focused kind of activities on the devices that seems to be most activating.
Yeah, well, talking about tracking the rates, and I feel like there's at least two major problems that can come out of over-focusing on that, and I'm sure there are several more. But the combination of you feel very helpless and overwhelmed by these statistics that on a personal level, there's only so much that we can do. And then also, I noticed on the website that there is potential for excessive worry about ourselves and our friends. And you have to sort of find that balance between empathy and sympathy, and then also realizing that you can't help everybody that's out there.
Yeah, I think that, you know, the point about, you know, wanting to follow and track, you know, part of the difficulty that we have right now with this pandemic is uncertainty, and people are struggling for ways in which they can control things. But, you know, there's a difference between, you know, being prepared and vigilant and being hypervigilant.
Mm.
It's that hypervigilance and that obsession that really doesn't help. And so people really need to truly practice healthy ways of getting through the day, having, you know, having schedule, having routine, but the routine not being 4 hours on social media.
Mm, right. What would constitute hypervigilance?
Well, I think in normal situations, you know, we're humans are kind of built for watching out for threat. And so in significantly threatening situations, primarily acutely, you know, people's hypervigilance can actually be self-preserving. But certainly what we found, and Dr. Wunderlich's done a lot of work on trauma, is that people are always on edge, always watching, always waiting for the next traumatic experience to happen. You get an increase in cortisol levels. You get, you know, chronic inflammation problems. You get things that are bad for both the brain and the body.
Mm.
And so it's learning the perspective of what is a truly acute, active threat versus, you know, what is something that we just need to be mindful of.
We're visiting with Dr. Andrew McLean, chair of the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Science at the University of North Dakota, and Dr. Stephen Wunderlich, vice president of research at Sanford Health, about a new website, behavioralhealthbridge.org, and a partnership between Sanford Health and the University of North Dakota to address behavioral and mental health concerns that are growing out of the COVID-19 pandemic. And Dr. Wunderlich, Dr. McLean just talked about trauma and how it shows up in the body. And another major section of the website is stress and coping. And I want to start with just how does stress show up in the body? And I assume this is not a blanket answer, but maybe some ways that we don't realize is really a stress response.
Sure. No, the way it shows up in the body is sort of complicated but very sophisticated, and that is when we are stressed in sometimes in very simple ways, but in especially when it is enduring kinds of stress like we're experiencing now, you'll get these biological stress response systems which get turned on. You know, it was the old fight or flight system that, you know, if you saw a threat, it was really good to have it so you could run and get away. But what happens is in these more enduring kinds of stressors, that same biological stress response system, the many people call it the HPA axis system, turns on, and as Dr. McLean said a few minutes ago, you get these increases in hormones which surge through the body and sort of get you prepared for trouble, for dealing with something. But when it's going on for months and months and months, this starts to take a toll, and you'll start to see things like not just sort of being kind of stressed out and maybe a little jumpy and a little wired, but you'll also start to notice things like your thinking changes. You start to pay attention to the world a little differently, something we call an attention bias. So when you feel like you're under threat, you start to look for threats. And if you're on social media, and you're just prone to, you're primed to pick up threatening material, which then just feeds back into the system and makes it worse. And so you get this sort of broadening, growing stress response, which doesn't settle down, and eventually people start to have significant physical problems, mental health problems, as a product of this sort of growing load.
Yeah, and that can show up even in just things that we wouldn't realize are symptoms of a behavioral health concern of, for example, just too much coffee, even something that simple.
Yeah, and headaches and stomach aches and body aches, the things that we don't immediately think, gee, this could be part of a behavioral health, mental health problem. But indeed, in an environment like we're living in right now, that's not out of the question.
I'm interested in what you just said, that it's really easy to find threats when you go out looking for threats. And I'm wondering about the role of, for example, a brain scan. And maybe this isn't within the context of your work, but do we know what's happening in the brain when we see and feel a threat? Is it, I mean, it seems like, and this is from a super non-medical professional here, that it's almost like an addiction for some people.
Well, there are certainly circuits in the brain that are stress activated. So there's parts of the brain that turn on, light up when you're under stress. And certainly there's going to be neurotransmitters and chemicals that are released in the brain during those episodes. It could be very similar to when you're engaging in other activities, and, you know, they might mimic or look like some kind of addiction or something like that. The thing, though, in a stress response is that ideally the brain, you know, kind of normalizes, and most people will normalize after a period of time. Some people, though, getting back to baseline and sort of dialing it back down doesn't happen. They stay activated. And in fact, in studies of children that have been traumatized, when you go in and you don't look at how their brains light up, but you simply do brain scans and look at the size of their brains, long-term stress shows that their brains begin to change in volume, in size, if they're under, you know, perpetual stress. And this is now reasonably well documented in the last couple of decades. The long-term stress not only changes the body, it literally changes the brain function and even brain structure.
Wow. Dr. McLean, there's an article on UND's website from 2018 about telepsychiatry, and I feel like in the world of telehealth, 2 years ago seems like a lifetime ago. What changes have you seen since just that article came out in May of 2018? Because, of course, the pandemic really brought telehealth right back up to the forefront.
Right. Yeah, exactly, Ashley. And you know, the good news is from the mental health side of things, both psychology and psychiatry, we've been doing telehealth care for some time. You know, the specialties of radiology and psychiatry have really been amenable to that kind of care. What we found is that, the assumption was that many patients wouldn't like that. And there are some circumstances in which they don't, but by and far, the patients typically accept, you know, telecare, you know, telepsychiatry quite well. It's a matter of actually convincing the providers to get adept at and comfortable with. Mm. And certainly the rest of medicine has come about because of this pandemic and because of the exemptions in reimbursements and what is allowed actually for treatment from a primary care standpoint. That's become more and more acceptable and more possible. What's really going to be interesting is, you know, what is the public's demand going to be once the pandemic is over? You know, there are many third-party payers who wouldn't pay for treatment of an individual by telehealth in the home. Hmm. Now we've seen that can happen, and there are significant benefits to that. And so, you know, what will remain and you know, what will change back to how it was?
Just one final question here, and Dr. McLean, we'll just let you go first, but I'd like you both to answer. How is your mental health working in both universities and hospitals during a pandemic?
Well, you know, for better or worse, you know, I've had some experience personally with the floods and gotten involved in disaster mental health. And so, you know, I've learned you know, what is helpful, what's not helpful. I do have colleagues, though, that, you know, have mentored me and helped me to recognize it's good to have that social connectedness with others as well, including our colleagues. Having somebody, you know, who you're open discussing with saying, you know, this is how I'm feeling, or I've noticed this is, you know, a little bit different for you. What's been going on? You know, that's actually a significant benefit. So not only the support, but actually having people who know you well kind of gauge and give you feedback. And so, you know, that's all part of just being open and understanding that this affects everybody.
Dr. Wunderlich?
Yeah, I'm reasonably well, but I'm not quite right. You know, I mean, I like everybody else, I've lost something. You know, all these things, the routines, the activities that I used to take for granted that I would do either daily or weekly, and they were an important part of my life, and they're not really part of my life right now. I have marveled at how much has been lost in terms of my daily activity time and what that means, and I feel it, and I recognize it. And like everybody else, you know, I'm trying to figure out ways to cope and manage and fill in the gap. I've suddenly become quite a walker. But it's, again, it's not quite right. But it also, for me, it has opened up some opportunities to think about, whoa, you know, so what is really important and what matters and how do you build a life that is resilient and not so vulnerable to major changes like this. So even though I spend a lot of time in my head and sometimes with other people's heads, this is a challenging time.
Well, best wishes to both of you. Dr. Wunderlich, thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
Dr. McLean, thank you for your time today.
Thanks, Ashley.
Ashley Thornburg in a discussion with Sanford Health's Dr. Stephen Wunderlich and Dr. Andrew McLean with the University of North Dakota School of Medicine and Health Sciences. Their informational website is behavioralhealthbridge.org. Coming up on Main Street, a new think tank report says North and South Dakota and Minnesota could see major economic benefits from the continued growth of clean energy. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The president of the North Dakota Farmers Union says exports to China have increased, but there is still a long way to go before we see purchase levels agreed to under this trade deal with the president struck with Chinese leadership. Mark Watney says soybean sales have increased when compared to a few months ago. He says corn is seeing the most activity. Watney says as it stands now, there is the potential we will see a trade deficit under phase one of the plan.
We're running about $3.5 billion behind currently in ag trade, which just is unusual for the U.S. It's one of the areas we usually help with our overall trade deficit is agriculture.
Watney says China has started buying products from other nations competing with us. He says that gives them the upper hand.
They only need to buy from us when they think it's appropriate. So one could guess that they stepped up their purchasing because the prices finally got low enough where it works better for them.
Watney says there is the chance U.S. growers will be able to recover some of the export market, but it won't happen quickly. The USDA has walked back predictions of record corn and soybean harvest this year, but as Harvest Public Media's Christina Stella reports, that could provide a much-needed boost for some grain farmers.
So far, corn production is expected to drop by 387 million bushels this year. Over 100 million fewer bushels of soybeans won't see harvest either. Economists like Chad Hart at Iowa State University blame Midwestern drought and a powerful derecho in Iowa and Illinois. But the smaller-than-expected crop is also increasing prices.
Anytime you're talking about 100 million bushels, that is a big movement as far as how things adjust here in the marketplace.
Average corn prices are up 40%, with soybeans selling nearly a dollar higher than last month. Christina Stella, Harvest Public Media.
And the president of Mayville State University is making the case to fund a new natural gas boiler for the campus. Brian Van Horn told the legislature's interim higher education committee Trail County does not yet have natural gas service.
Currently, we have to use fuel oil, which is one of the most inefficient ways to heat, to start our season and to end our season.
Van Horn says it is Trail County's top economic development piece to bring natural gas to the county. Van Horn says a process to do that is underway, and he says the cost would be $1.6 million.
It gives long-term savings to our campus. And it's cleaner, and it's a very reliable fuel source, and probably most of you are already using it in your communities, I would bet.
Van Horn says the project is near the top of the State Board of Higher Education's priority list for capital projects for the 2021 legislature. Van Horn says natural gas service should be available in the county by the fall of 2021. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and today we're talking about lots of things, but the fall membership drive is big in our minds, and Ashley Thornburg and I are reminding our Main Street listeners that listeners who become members make us possible, right, Ashley?
Absolutely. It pays for the bulk of what you hear on the radio, and not just the programs themselves, but the actual infrastructure that we need to put out this service, and helping to pay for the staff that actually has to do the work. And fall, you know, there's just certain chores you have to get done before winter, like you start to get your lawnmower ready, you start to get the snowblower ready to be used while the lawnmower goes away. Why not just get this off of your to-do list with a simple phone call, 800-359-4145, or click and join at prairiepublic.org. There's a lot of things to love about fall, the beautiful leaves, the fact that everything tastes like pumpkin spice, the little bit of chill in the air, there's not so many mosquitoes, and it's nice to be able to just sit out on the deck, maybe put on a favorite sweater and listen to quality shows that you hear on Prairie Public. That's what you're supporting when you call 800-359-4145 or when you click and join at prairiepublic.org.
Prairie Public is the North Dakota home for National Public Radio, NPR. And of course, the big story that's been global and national and regional and in our state is the coronavirus and its impact on our economy, on our lives. It's disrupted just about every piece of what we do. And we've been following this story in great detail, taking it apart in many cases to find out what those effects really are and how they're changing the way we do stuff and may change it forever, for that matter. We learned this through credible medical experts, and we learned it from policy experts, people who know what they're talking about, talking to you. because you're important. This is Prairie Public, and you are the public. So our fall membership drive means that we ask you to remember that, that we're not advertiser-supported. We are member-supported. And that's why we ask you to pick up the phone and give us a call at 800-359-4145 or pledge online at prairiepublic.org. It does not take very long, but it's very important. And for those of you who have done it, thank you.
Doug, you said a couple of my favorite words in there, member supported, but also just as importantly, the word experts. And I want to stress that when you are tuning into a high quality news service, you are hearing from experts in the field who have both the research and knowledge base and also a professional code of ethics to adhere to give you this information. This is not Karen on Facebook says blah, blah, blah. This is information that has been vetted and digested and given to you in a way that makes sense so that you can go into your day well informed. The number to call, 800-359-4145 or prairiepublic.org.
Joining me now, Frank Manzo IV. He's with the Illinois Economic Policy Institute. He's that director. Frank, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And Jill Gigstand is with the Midwest Economic Policy Institute. She's a researcher, and that's associated with that Illinois group. Jill, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
And Frank, we're talking today about a new report that just came out titled Building Good Jobs in the Great Plains Through Clean Energy Investments, Impacts in Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota. So what prompted you to do this study?
Right. This study was prompted by the growing recognition that states are looking to invest in clean energy as a jobs creator in the wake of a unfortunate recession caused by a global pandemic. And so, what we found in looking at North Dakota, South Dakota, and Minnesota in particular, which are three leading producers of energy in the United States broadly, is that those three states are poised to lead a clean energy boom as the region works to recover from that recession. And embracing the transition to clean energy will promote not only environmental health, but also diversify the economy and boost employment.
Jill, the study emphasizes how much wind energy in particular has grown in this particular part of the country. What can you tell our listeners about the importance of wind energy to the overall energy scheme that our country has?
Right, that's correct. So in North Dakota actually ranks 12th in total wind capacity, and over 40% of all energy in North Dakota is renewable. And really, wind energy is just, it's great environmental health, and it's good for climate change, since that's a concern. But really, clean energy is an economic opportunity. And investment in wind energy really is great for the state's overall expansion towards more clean energy sources.
Now, your report, you indicate that investments in clean energy create more jobs than investments in fossil energy. We've been hearing the other side of that argument, which argues otherwise. Make the case.
So I'll go ahead, Jill. This is now Frank talking. Our report uses an industry standard economic impact analysis software called IMPLAN to look at the effect of every $1 billion invested in different types of power or energy. And what we find is that for every $1 billion invested in clean energy, more than 7,000 total jobs are created, and the economy is boosted by $1.3 billion. So it's a positive return on investment. Those are both more than fossil fuel investments right now in the year 2020. However, it is worth noting there's an important but here, and the but is that the clean energy sector has historically had lower worker wages and more out-of-state workers coming in to work on those projects than the fossil fuel power sector. And that's an important point because it's harder to attract and retain skilled local workers in clean energy careers. And we think that The Great Plains and upper Midwest states need to work to correct that.
Jill, why is that? Why do clean energy jobs on average offer less compensation than fossil fuel jobs?
A big reason why clean energy sector workers earn lower wages than the traditional energy and infrastructure sectors is because they're less unionized. Years of collective bargaining in a traditional energy and infrastructure sector source and stuff like that, they've produced workplaces and work sites where wages, health insurance coverage, retirement plans, and training contributions are generally better for workers. So if wind and solar companies, environmentalists, governments, if they want to attract qualified and skilled craft workers in North Dakota, in South Dakota, in Minnesota, they have to start competing with fossil fuel-based sectors that have better wages, better benefits, and better job security for workers.
Jill Gigstand is the Midwest Economic Policy Institute researcher behind a new report, Building Good Jobs in the Great Plains Through Clean Energy. Frank Manzo IV is the Institute Director for the Illinois Economic Policy Institute. Frank, in this report, and Jill mentioned that union laborers typically make more money in the energy sector than non-union workers, particularly competing wind versus coal in our case. You cite in this report an idea called project labor agreements. Fill our listeners in about what that means.
Sure. So project labor agreements are comprehensive pre-hire agreements on large construction projects that establish terms and conditions of employment. Now, what that means is that they typically include important labor standards, such as apprenticeship ratios and targeted local hire requirements. Now, what that means there is that a certain amount of the work completed on those projects should be apprentices. That's usually 10 or 15%. And that a certain percentage should also be local workers, which is very, very important in North Dakota, where research shows that 86% of the workers on North Dakota's wind projects have come from out of state. So project labor agreements are a way to not only ensure labor peace, because they also prohibit work stoppages or strikes, but they also are a way to stabilize the pool of skilled workers and help ensure that more residents of North Dakota are actually working on those projects.
Jill, your report does indicate that a large percentage of the people who are employed in these enterprises, wind in particular, in this particular case, are from out of state. So that sort of underscores Frank's statement there that the state needs to do something, or the utility needs to do something, to encourage people locally, I guess, to take those jobs.
Right. And while record low unemployment prior to COVID-19 and the recession that is now happening and is going to hopefully stop at some point, but basically record low unemployment is part of the reason why there was a skilled labor shortage in the clean energy sector. So, and clean energy firms were saying that they couldn't find skilled workers. But really, it's also a reflection of relatively lower job quality in the sector. So these jobs need to be local, and we need to, these jobs should go to skilled workers from this region. And the clean energy sector and firms, in order to compete with these industries that pay better, need to address this issue.
The point is that job quality matters. And right now, wind and solar power employers need to raise worker pay in order to attract, develop, and retain skilled workers, because right now, a staggering 86% of workers on North Dakota's wind projects are coming from out of state, and that costs the North Dakota economy more than $60 million per year.
As you probably know, Frank, North Dakota has a tradition of coal-fired power plants, too. We export a lot of energy from North Dakota, far more than we need to use here. And the Coal Creek Station is the state's largest, and that is set to close in just a couple of years. And they've been talking out in that part of the state in central North Dakota where those lignite coal fields are that feed those furnaces that are right next to the mines, that we're talking about 700 people working in the mine and, you know, quite a few people working in the power plant too. And so when we talk about jobs for wind energy, are we talking about jobs that go on or are we just talking about construction jobs?
This is a very, very important point. And the point is that the fossil fuel sector has historically provided very, very good middle-class jobs that are with family supporting wages and benefits that support local economies. So when 700 jobs go away, they should be, if they are going to be replaced with clean energy, should be replaced with jobs of the same quality. And I'm using the term jobs, and what I really should be using is the term careers. We need good careers to maximize the economic benefits of renewable energy for the industry.
So what should states do to maximize economic benefits from this potential growth?
So to maximize the economic benefits of renewable energy, it is important for the industry first and foremost to develop the kind of institutional arrangements to better compete for skilled workers and help transition displaced workers, those 700 displaced workers you mentioned, from those, you know, traditional energy sources to clean energy sources that are actually creating jobs, more jobs in the fossil fuel sector in these states. Now, specifically, the states could implement, as you mentioned earlier, project labor agreements on more clean energy projects. They could incentivize those, especially on utility scale projects. And that would help increase work for local contractors and local workers, as well as North Dakota could consider implementing what's called prevailing wage and prevailing wage standards on these clean energy projects. Now, neighboring Minnesota has a prevailing wage law for construction workers. North Dakota does not. So this would require state to implement a law that does not exist in the state at this time.
Jill, one of the features of renewable energy, particularly wind energy, is that it's typically placed in a rural area, a windy rural area, but ideally suited for this kind of power generation. So that makes this kind of renewable energy perhaps particularly valuable to rural communities.
That is exactly correct. Rural areas need jobs just as much as urban areas, and this investment in clean energy, especially wind and solar projects that are best out in rural areas, are a great way to hire those local workers. And one other thing I'll just mention too, it's actually also cheaper to build these projects out in rural areas, and it's more cost effective.
The Secretary of Energy Dan Brulette was in our state recently to talk about fossil fuel jobs. It's a political season as well. And he said, and I'm quoting him, "If anyone misses the point of why baseload energy is important, coal-fired power plants providing baseload energy, reliable 24-hour, 7-day-a-week, 365-day-a-year energy, look at California, which has occasionally these rolling blackouts and or brownouts. And that's because of that state's focus on renewables, and sometimes they don't have the baseline power. So what's the argument there for renewables? And, I mean, we need some sort of balance here. It can't be all or nothing, can it?
The answer to that question is it does require balance, and it requires a unfortunately long but also hopefully just transition towards more clean energy. We need to stabilize the current energy portfolio to ensure that reliability as a backstop if wind and solar power experiences issues because it's not windy one day or it's not very sunny for a prolonged period of time. So we need to maintain some level over the very near term of traditional energy sources, coal-fired, natural gas, things like that. That being said, wind and solar energy are becoming more and more reliable and more cost effective as the years go on. So the hope is that eventually, by by a target date of by 2050 at least, that those are fully reliable, that we do not need that backstop of coal and natural gas.
Frank Manzo IV is the Illinois Economic Policy Institute director. Jill Gigstand is the Midwest Economic Policy Institute researcher. They collaborated on a report, Building Good Jobs in the Great Plains Through Clean Energy Investments, Impacts in Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota. You can find out more of what they do at MidwestEPI for Economic Policy Institute .org. Frank and Jill, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
Dakota Datebook is next.
Some people measure a year in months, others in football seasons, but if you measure a year in breaking news events, you're probably thinking it's 2023 by now. When you donate, you help our journalists keep you informed of everything that's happening and to remind you that, yes, it's still 2020. Make today count. Give to this NPR station now.
Support Prairie Public by becoming a sustaining member. Just go to prairiepublic.org.
This is Dakota Datebook for September 14th. Emma Kelly was quite an adventurous person, for she was among the first women to endure the extreme conditions of the Alaskan Klondike Gold Rush in 1897. She also established a farm in North Dakota as a homesteader on the south shore of Devil's Lake in 1904. On this date in 1904, the Bismarck Tribune described Emma Kelly as a writer of ability and a woman of culture who had fearless and romantic experiences before her arrival in North Dakota. Born in Kansas in 1873, Emma Leonidas Kelly was the daughter of Mr. and Mrs. Henry B. Kelly. Emma's father was a regionally known newspaper editor and Kansas state senator, and Emma had worked in the newspaper office before graduating from college. By age 22, Emma Kelly was a sales representative for a Kansas City paper. In 1897, Emma moved to Chicago to work in newspaper advertising, but she grabbed an opportunity to go to Alaska, to the Yukon Klondike Gold Rush, with financial support from a Chicago business syndicate. Fully outfitted with cold weather clothing, plus a Bowie knife, revolver, rifle, and shotgun, Emma traveled to the gold fields. She got rich with her own shrewd mining claims, returning to Kansas after 1 year with $50,000 and plenty of gold nuggets. For some years thereafter, Emma wrote magazine articles about her Alaskan expedition and also went on a lecture tour, telling her chilling far north stories. In 1904, Emma Kelly heard about land becoming available in North Dakota, when the U.S. government opened up 100,000 acres of the Devil's Lake, Spirit Lake, reservation for outsiders to join a lottery for a chance to settle on the land. 'Twas a good deal for outsiders, but it was devastating long-term for the tribe. Emma Kelly, age 31, got lottery number 37 and chose land on the south shore of Devil's Lake, paying $4.50 per acre for her 160-acre homestead. 2 years later, she married Lewis S. McClelland from Kansas, a railway passenger agent. They bought 800 nearby acres, living alternately in Kansas City and at their 1,000-acre Devil's Lake Ranch. By 1912, the McClellands moved to New York City, but supervised their ranch during the summer. Lewis died in 1922, and then Emma died in New York in 1934. Memories of the once famous Emma Kelly McClellan as gold miner in Alaska and farmer in North Dakota have now faded into history. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Dr. Steve Hoffbeck with research by Isabella Grafstrom. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Just a few minutes left in Main Street to remind you that we are in our fall membership drive. Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg and all of you listening out there who might be thinking, is this the time I become a member? This is a great time to become a member because this is your show. If you're listening and you've listened now for almost an hour, you are engaged in what we're talking about, and we appreciate that, and we look forward to your feedback as well. And you can give that feedback by calling us with your information and your pledge and your support at 800-359-4145 or going online at prairiepublic.org.
It really is your show. This is programming that is reflective of what life is like in this region. Of course, you need to be informed about what's going on nationally and internationally, but we don't want to do that at the expense of you knowing what's happening around here, because that's going to have a lot more immediate effect on your actual quality of life. So a show like Main Street, in addition to the news programming, you get to go in depth with what is happening around here. And Doug, for the 3 weeks that I've been filling in for you, I've had some fascinating conversations with the people from this region, from counselors and therapists who are moving their practices over to Zoom, to a comedy style talk show, late night talk show that is being filmed in Minot, and it's hilarious. And we love to hear from the people in this region who are doing interesting things, who are very engaged, smart people who really care about the human condition. And ultimately, that is the kind of interviewing that we love to provide and that we can only continue to provide with membership support. So give us a call now at 800-359-4145 or prairiepublic.org.
You know, Ashley, I went online to see that Minot show. It was a lot of fun.
Good?
Yeah. It's very creative, and that's the kind of stuff that you hear on Main Street you may not hear anywhere else.
Yeah.
Because we take the time to talk about this amongst ourselves. It's the three of us. It's sort of the three musketeers here, Skip Wood and Ashley Thornburg and myself. And we take time, we think, we hope, to curate interesting and newsworthy conversations. We hope you appreciate that. If you do, please know that we can only take this kind of time to let the human voice breathe and the good conversation flow because you have responded and supported a radio station, a network like Prairie Public. You can continue that help by contributing at prairiepublic.org or giving us a call at 800-359-4145.
And we're actually going to hear an interview later this week or next week, the story idea that I got from the people from Goodnight Minot. But what's coming up tomorrow?
Well, as part of our continuing interviews with statewide candidates, we'll meet with Shelley Lenz-Vig. She's the Democratic NPL candidate for governor. Prairie Public Television programming is now live streaming. So program manager Chris Meisner will join us to tell us about that and also to share news of the new fall season. And of course, we'll continue to remind you that we're asking for support from new and sustaining members. Is that you? We hope you can join us for Main Street on Tuesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.